This is Kurt Benrud, and welcome again to Did You Know? This is a special broadcast geared to the celebration of what happened on October 12th.
This is Pam Vesper, and this program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. And indeed, we are celebrating a very important event.
This is Bob Martin, and I can't wait to find out what's so special about October 12th.
Okay, Bob, we have four possibilities. See if you can guess which one.
Ooh, I'm ready.
All right, on October 12th, 1917, Lions International was founded.
Or how about this? On October 12th, 1933, Alcatraz became a federal prison.
Or on October 12th, 1960, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev disrupted a United Nations General Assembly meeting.
And on October 12th, 1492, Christopher Columbus discovered the New World.
Christopher who?
Do you mean to say you haven't heard of Christopher Columbus?
Oh, of course. I've heard of Christopher Columbus. I was just funning with you. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Back in grade school, everybody remembered those lines.
Good for you. Now, that was a standard mnemonic that they used to help remember the event of Columbus discovering the New World.
Right. But we've come to discover...
Ah, nice, Pam.
Thank you. That not everything we were taught back in those days was accurate.
So... we thought today on Did You Know, we're going to present some little bits of information that will make the knowledge of what we celebrate more accurate.
We think the best way to start is with Bob.
Well, thank you. I remember everything I was taught back in school.
That's what we're hoping for. Go ahead, tell us what you remember about Christopher Columbus.
Oh, okay. Columbus was born in Italy, Genoa, I think. It was a time when people believed that the world was flat. Well, Columbus knew otherwise, and he believed that he could find a faster way to the east, where the spice trade was flourishing. He was going to sail westward. He tried to convince others, but he couldn't, until he talked with Queen Isabella of Spain. She believed in him and even pawned her personal jewels in order to raise the money needed to make the trip. He equipped three ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and they started off across the ocean. They arrived on the coast of America on October 12th, 1492. Pretty good memory, huh?
Anything about that story that bothers you?
Well, yeah. The teachers could never explain why the country was named America instead of Columbia.
Well, Bob, he did have three ships, and he did land on October 12th, 1492. We'll get to where he landed later, but the rest isn't true.
What?
All right, let's start with the world being flat. First, the primitive navigation techniques of their time relied on the stars and the curvature of the earth to locate position at sea. The Venerable Bede mentions this fact when he's doing his writings in the 8th century.
And even earlier, a Greek astronomer had measured the circumference of the earth with good precision in the 2nd century BCE.
Well, where did we get the idea the earth was flat?
Are you ready for this? That suggestion was made in a book written in 1828 entitled A History of the Life and Times of Christopher Columbus. It was written by Washington Irving and is classified today as a work of historical fiction.
Washington Irving? He wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle.
Yep. So here we have a scientific principle established in the 2nd century BCE, used by ocean navigators for hundreds of years before 1492, and when contrasted with a work of historical fiction from the 19th century, which do people choose to believe?
And teach me in school?
That too.
But while Columbus knew that the earth was round, he made some serious miscalculations. First, he believed the landmass of Europe-Asia was larger than it was, which meant he thought he'd have less ocean to cross.
He also calculated distances on the map using Italian miles, about 1,238 meters, as opposed to the actual map calculations, which was 1,830 meters.
Well, how much of a difference would that actually make?
A big difference. One way, the Earth measures 25,255 kilometers around. The other, it measures 40,000 kilometers.
Well, that's about 37% bigger.
And since Columbus believed there was only open water between Europe and Asia, that's an additional 15,000 kilometers without food or fresh water.
Those are some big miscalculations. Did he get anything right?
Yes, he did, and it was a biggie. If you ever look at a map of Columbus' voyages, you'll see that he didn't sail in a straight line, which would have been the shortest route. he knew or learned en route about the trade winds.
The trade winds?
Right. In that part of the ocean, the winds don't blow in one direction. They actually blow in a kind of circle.
When he left the Canary Islands, he was propelled by winds blowing eastward. If he traveled back against those winds, it would have taken him months.
But there are winds following a northerly path that head back toward northern Europe and then south to the Iberian Peninsula. So on returning, he uses those westerlies and sails in a kind of circle, not even getting to the Easter Islands on the way home.
Okay, now, help me here. Put that in a way that I can understand.
Okay, how about this? 15,000 kilometers equals 9,320 miles. The average speed of Columbus ships was 100 miles a day. On the phenomenal day, it could be 200 miles. Let's take an average of 150 miles a day. To cover that additional distance of 9,320 miles, it would have taken Columbus another 62 days.
Now think of that in terms of his whole trip. It took him 1 month to get from Spain to the Easter Islands, then 5 weeks from Easter Islands to the sighting of land. If there was no Americas in the way, he would have spent another 8 weeks to get to Asia.
And the crew was ready to mutiny after 5 weeks because they didn't see any land.
Another 8 weeks.
And if he hadn't used the trade winds, we would have never gotten home alive.
I gotta think about that for a minute.
Well, while you're thinking, how about some word origins? We haven't done any of those in a long while.
Well, I'm ready for that. Where do we start?
Let's start with a twist.
Good. I like to dance, but I prefer the slow music.
Okay, wrong twist. These are words where we give you three choices of their origin, and you get to guess. They're called where words. See what you think.
Oh, I can do that.
All right, here we go. The first word is sock. Do we call them that because A, they were first woven from fine Egyptian linen called sacks? B, they were named for Sir William Saxbury, who first wore them in public, or C, it comes from the Latin word socus, a shoe made of thin leather.
I know this. They had an exhibit at the Louvre. The Greeks had them first, but Roman soldiers wore them as boot liners. Later, the socus was clipped to socks. My turn. Tuxedo. A, named after the tuxedo penguin. B, Mark Twain ridiculed fancy menswear, calling it tailored and tuxed. Or C, it made its debut in 1866 at a country club in Tuxedo Park, New York.
Oh, got it. I was also in Paris.
You were in Paris, France?
No, Paris, Arkansas. My grandmother was born there. Anyway, she once met Peter Lorillard, the heir to the tobacco fortune. He wore the first one to the autumn ball at his country club in Tuxedo Park, New York.
Your grandmother met Peter Lorillard?
What made you think that? She wasn't even born until 1882.
Okay, umbrella. A, it was patterned after the Alaskan umbriac, a round canoe. B, from the Latin umbra, which meant shade. C, for its inventor, Londoner Ed Umbrell.
I don't think you'll have two inventors in a row. I picked the shade. I know it used to be considered unmanly for a man to attempt to avoid the rain, but ladies use them to avoid the sun. How about this one? Pajamas. A, named for the town of origin, Pajama, in Central America. B, from the Farsi pay, for leg, and yama, for cover. They originally started out as pants. Or C, they were developed and marketed by flannel baron Sanjib Pahima.
Those are good possibilities. But my grandmother in Paris used to wear them.
The same grandmother who didn't know Peter Lorillard.
No, her twin sister. Early, both men and women wore nightgowns. Then women's got filmier and men's got shorter. They called them nightshirts. Loose pants were worn at the bottom. They were called pajamas because they covered the legs. Eventually, the whole thing got called pajamas. Okay? How about gloves? A, from the Anglo-Saxon, glof, meaning palm of the hand. B, named for Sir Gloverston, a knight of the round table. Or C, the oldest pair came from King Tut's glovery chamber.
From the Anglo-Saxon. Men had been wearing gloves for 10,000 years. Battle, you know. Women didn't get into the practice until the mid-16th century, and then not as protection, but as a fashion statement. Now, trousers. A, from the Gaelic trews for leg covers. B. Leather garments first worn by Nordic fishermen on the river Trau. C. After a French prelate, Henri Trousier, who wore them under his robes.
Pretty tricky, Kurt, from your background. Do I go Gaelic or Norwegian? I'm going to go with Gaelic. By the way, did you know that while anyone can wear the pants in the family, only men can wear trousers? When women wear them, they're called slacks. Okay, one last chance. Shoes. A, from the practice of throwing them at unwanted critters while hollering, shoe. B, from the Anglo-Saxon siu, plural for shuis, meaning to cover. Or C, it was popularized by a Japanese leather merchant, shuzi.
I don't think there would be another Anglo-Saxon answer. How about the guy who threw the shoe at President Bush? Oh, he didn't yell shoe, though.
No, Bob. It's from the Anglo-Saxon. Egyptians had made footwear from papyrus as early as 2000 BCE. The Greeks fashioned them from leather about 600, and the Romans made lefts and rights about 200 BCE. It's from the Anglo-Saxon.
I think it's time to get back to Columbus. We know Columbus was not trying to prove to the world that the earth was round. He was interested in finding a faster way into the lucrative spice trade. There were big bucks to be made, so before he puts out to sea, he needs financing.
Okay, to the story of Isabella and her jewels.
In a bit. In 1485, Columbus appealed for funds for his adventure from the King of Portugal.
Well, wait a minute. Ferdinand and Isabella were in Spain.
That's right. And Columbus went first to Portugal, not Spain. The king had his advisors review the request and deemed Columbus was mistaken in his estimates of distance. Request denied. In 1486, he goes to Spain. Also rejected. Also, Spain is at war with the Muslims. He then goes to Genoa and Venice. Also denied. In 1488, he appeals again to Portugal. Another rejection. Also, shortly after this, Portuguese navigator Bartholomew Dias successfully rounded the Cape of Good Hope. So a route around Africa was now established, and Portugal was not interested in trailblazing.
In 1488, Columbus is back in Spain, again rejected. He must think something is possible in Spain because he keeps at them, and in 1492, with the war with the Muslims now over, they agree.
And now the jewels.
And now not the jewels. The appeal to Queen Isabella was turned down on the advice of her confessor. Then Ferdinand intervened, and Isabella sent a messenger to call Columbus back. Later, Ferdinand even claimed personal responsibility for the discovery of the islands.
What islands? He discovered America.
No, not really. We'll get to that part of the story in a minute. Half of the financing came from Italian investors. The rest came from the Spanish treasury. Now listen to the deal he made. By contract with the Crown of Spain, Columbus was to be named Admiral of the Sea and would be appointed Viceroy and Governor of all new lands. He would be entitled to 10% of the revenues of all new lands in perpetuity. And finally, he would have the option of buying a 1/8 interest in any commercial venture from the new lands and receive 1/8 of the profits.
Wow. I wonder how he would have done with hedge funds.
Okay, one more thing before we set off to sea. Did you know that one of the maps that Columbus had access to was made by a Norwegian?
Really?
Come on, Kurt. Are you just making that up like Chekhov on the old Star Trek series?
Well, consider this. According to the Greenlanders saga, in 986, a trader named Bjarni Herjulfsson left Norway on his way back home to Iceland. When he got home, he found his father, Herjulf, had left for the new settlement in Greenland, and he followed.
Well, how did they know his name was Herjulf?
Because Bjarni's name was Herjulfsson, Herjulf's son.
Oh, like Johnson.
Right. Bjarni got lost in the fog and ended up off the coast of a new land covered with a forest and low hills. Though he didn't set foot on this land, he brought back stories of it. One person who was impressed by the story was Leif Erikson.
Yeah. Erikson.
Right again. Leif bought Bjarni's boat and set off for this new place. He landed on the coast of Canada.
Are we sure about that?
In the 1960s, Norwegian archaeologists found an entire Norse settlement on the north coast of Newfoundland. A map of the area called the Vineland Map was drawn by a Dane, Claudius Clavius, between 1420 and 1440.
Drawn by a Dane.
Based on a much earlier map drawn by a Norwegian.
Are you sure of that?
Would I lie to you? My word as a Scotsman.
You can't argue with that.
And as late as 2002, radiocarbon dating showed this map to be authentic.
But would Columbus have known about it?
In May of 1476, he was part of a convoy sent by Genoa to northern Europe. Among the ports he docked at were Bristol, Galway, and Iceland. In 1479, he joined his brother Bartolomeo in Lisbon, where he was working as a map maker.
That sounds good to me.
Okay, I'll accept that. So now we're ready to set to sea on the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. The Santa Maria was the largest of the ships, a big merchant-type ship capable of carrying lots of cargo. It had a crew of 50 men. The Pinta was smaller, and the Niña was smaller yet, each with crews of 18 men.
You know, I've heard that actually there were four ships that Columbus started out with.
Four?
Yeah. One sailed off the edge.
I think it's time for more word origins.
I like those where words. Do we have any more?
Ah, we sure do. And these all deal with products in the home. The first one is aspirin. Did the name come from A, it was originally taken to relieve breathing or aspiration? B, it came from the willow tree, whose Latin name is spirea? C, the first box was printed with A, period, S, period, pirin, the name of its chemical inventor. What do you think?
I know this. There's an exhibit at the Louvre in Paris. Aspirin is acetylic acid and supposedly goes back to ancient remedies employing the use of willow bark. It was rediscovered in 1893, and chemists at Bayer in Germany took the A from acetyl and spear from spirea and added in. There it is, aspirin. My turn. Laxative. A, a former trademark name, Relaxactive. B, a transliteration of luxative, a castor oil from Luxembourg. Or C, from the Latin luxos, or loose.
I studied Latin in high school. It means loose. The name was developed by a pharmacist who called it an excellent laxative. Shortened, Paxlax. I got one. Witch hazel. So called because A, it's made from the witch hazel plant. B, it was named after a Salem witch, not the one in the comic strip, the real one. Or C, it was the original trademark for a brand of astringent.
I would have gone for the Salem witch until you said it wasn't the witch hazel from the comic strip.
Really?
No, it's a plant. In the fall, after the leaves drop off, the shrub produces a yellow flower. Natives thought it was magic and learned to use it to soothe cuts and abrasions. How about ibuprofen? A, from the Swedish ibuprofen, which means no profit since the inventor gave up the patent. B, developed for the International Ballet Union in Germany. It was IBU, as in ibuprofen. C, it comes from the chemical name, isobutylphenylpropionic acid.
Nobody can say that name, let alone go into a drugstore and ask for it. That's got to be it.
Right you are.
Try this one. Shampoo. A nonsense name for a kind of soap used to wash dogs. B, from the Hindu shampoo, meaning to massage. Or C, from the French champeau, meaning waterland.
I also studied English history.
You really did?
Oh, I had time after Latin. In the 1870s in England, Hindu fashions, art, and phrases were all the rage. Hindu hairdressers took advantage and added the word to the vocabulary.
Hmm.
All right, now, cologne. A, first extracted from an orchid genus called Colognus. B, it's the plural of the Italian word cologna, which means bouquet. Or C, after the German city of Cologne, where it was developed.
I also studied Latin in school.
Oh, wow. Say something in Latin.
Okay. Omnia Gallia est divisa in tres partes.
Ooh, and the answer to that is barco barcare, doggy bite 'em.
Amen. An Italian barber was living in Cologne, Germany, and created a concoction that he used in his barbershop. He called it Water of Cologne, later shortened to just Cologne. And comb. A. The first were comb and brush combinations, or combos. B. Named after British dandy John Breck, the Duke of Combs. C. From the ancient Indo-European word comhos, for teeth.
You know, I also went to school.
Ooh, it must have been a fad in those days.
Must have been. The first combs were backbone or jawbones, gombos, of fish. Depictions of them have been found in 6,000-year-old cave art. And finally, how about soap? A, from Middle English soap, which meant to trickle or run out. B, from Cheops' sister, Shope, who used to bathe daily in 996 BCE. Or C, it's a recipe, salt, oil, alkali, and potash.
My grandmother used to stir up her own soap. I used to watch her make it.
You used to watch your grandmother make soap?
Sure. We were a clean family. Anyway, I sat and learned how.
Whatever recipe she used, it wasn't soap.
You're right about that. However, it came to mean trickle. Nobody seems to know, but trickle it is.
The soap used to run down the sides of her kettle.
I think it's time for some more Columbus.
I think you're right. Back to our story. For Columbus, it is the evening of August 3rd, 1492, and time to set sail from Palos de la Frontera.
But before they left, the king forced the inhabitants of the town to contribute to the expedition. The royal treasury was depleted from the war, remember?
Well, at least they didn't raise taxes.
So they sailed to the Canary Islands, which was owned by Castile at the time. There they were provisioned and left on September 6th for what turned out to be 5 weeks at sea.
I remember the next part. After 5 weeks at sea, the crew was sure they were lost and they were all going to die. So they were just on the point of mutiny to force Columbus to return to Spain. At 2 a.m. on the 12th of October, the lookout from the Pinta sighted moonlight shimmering on sand. No mutiny. They landed safely, and Columbus discovered America.
Well, not quite. Where they landed is now called the Bahamas.
The Bahamas? You know, a few miles farther north and more open water, the crew might have mutinied and America would have never been discovered.
I doubt that. Another fact about Columbus, maybe to forestall the talk of mutiny, Columbus offered a huge reward to the first man who saw land. When the lookout said he saw the shimmering of moonlight on the sand, Columbus claimed that he had seen it the night before and so kept the reward for himself.
Quite a guy. I bet he would have made a good pirate.
No pirate would have done that to his crew.
Columbus named the island they landed on San Salvador. This may be the current San Salvador, but that subject is still debated. The indigenous people of the island were the Taino, or Arawak. He wrote in his journal that the people were peaceful and friendly, and observed that they ought to make good servants because they quickly repeat everything we say to them.
He looked at them as servants, not friends?
He also commented that they could easily be made Christians, for they seemed to have no religion, at least none that Columbus recognized. He also said that, if it pleased the Lord, he would take 6 natives with him to present to your highness and would teach them the Spanish language.
And lastly, noting their lack of metalworking, he wrote, I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I please.
Well, that's a good start for America.
Bob?
Oh, sorry. And then he started home?
No. Then he explored the northeast coast of Cuba and the northern coast of Hispaniola. On Christmas Day, the Santa Maria ran aground and had to be abandoned. He left 39 men behind to form a settlement on what is now Haiti. Now he was ready to sail for home. But before he did, Columbus kidnapped 25 natives to take back with him.
Well, let's see. 86 men started out, 39 were left on Haiti, and 25 future servants added. And all to fit on those ships that started out with 18 men each? I bet the natives didn't get the guest cabins.
Worse. You can imagine the conditions because only 7 or 8 of them survived the trip. But when they arrived back in Spain, the natives made quite a hit in Seville.
They sailed into the harbor of Palos on March 15, 1493, and the word that new lands had been discovered quickly spread across Europe.
I don't remember any mention of spices. Didn't the king and queen ask about the spices?
Well, they probably did, but they had the natives and a promise of new lands. Plus, they brought back something more important than spices.
More important than spices? I don't remember any mention of gold. What did they bring back that was more important than spices?
Well, they may not have brought back a lot of it, but they had discovered tobacco. The natives rolled it into cigars and smoked it. Pretty soon, tobacco was fully introduced into Spain, and by 1558, Portugal had introduced snuff. A local herb quickly changed from a native practice to an international addiction.
I wonder if the Tainos had any smoke-free zones.
I wonder if it's not time for a play from our future famous authors of Carolina.
The play is from the Cary Playwrights Forum. It's entitled Fly in the Eggnog, with Jeff Nugent and Pam Vesper.
The scene is a living room with a visible door to the kitchen. It's a couple of days before Christmas, and Mom is busy with the kids preparing a big day while she waits for her husband to get home from his successful job as a director of marketing downtown. The characters, Frank, a 45-year-old professional man on a stable career path. His wife, Valerie, 42, super mom, who cooks, cleans, and volunteers for everything. And two children, Matthew, a son, age 13, and Megan, a daughter, 11. When the scene opens, it is 4 days before Christmas. The Harper family is in full-on holiday mode. Valerie and the kids have been cooking all afternoon while they wait for Frank to return home from work. The scene opens with Frank coming in, talking on the telephone, with Valerie entering shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I know. No, I can't tell her that now. Are you nuts? It's Christmas. It would ruin it for her and the kids, and I just can't do that. I know. Not till after the holidays. I don't care. I know she deserves the truth, but she should hear it from me. Oh, well, here she comes. I gotta go.
Hey, you're home. Look what we've been doing this afternoon. Want one?
That looks great. What's for dinner?
I was thinking we could go to Antonelli's after I clean up. We've been baking all afternoon, and I'd really like to get out of the kitchen.
Don't we have anything here? I'm wasted. It's been a really long day.
What part of I want to get out of this kitchen do you not understand?
I just got off the highway with all that traffic. I really don't feel like getting back in the car. Why don't we just order a pizza, then?
I don't mind driving. I'll have two martinis instead of a three. It'll be worth it to have a relaxing meal where somebody else cleans up. You're already outvoted anyway, so go change. All you need to bring is your wallet.
Okay. But can't we go somewhere else? Antonelli's is so expensive.
It's Christmas, Mr. Scrooge. Besides, Antonelli's is tradition, and we haven't been there yet this year.
Well, why does a $200 meal have to be a tradition? Just because we've gone there the last couple of years doesn't mean we can't try something different.
No, come on. We've been going there forever. What's wrong with you tonight? You love Antonelli's as much as the kids do.
Whatever. We'll go. Let me change.
Frank leaves the room. He reappears later that night.
Get ready for bed, you two. I'll pop the popcorn and we'll watch Charlie Brown when you're all ready.
Just let me sit down.
So I was thinking...
Uh-oh.
Frank.
What?
There's a few more gifts I need to get, and I was wondering...
More gifts? What else do you need to get?
Well, there's just a couple more things on the kids' list that I haven't been able to pick up. Plus, I always get something for the ladies' auxiliary, my bunko buddies.
I've seen that stack in our closet. You bought enough. Why can't you just give those other people cards?
It's just a couple of things. I need an hour or so tomorrow to get them, and I was hoping you could...
I honestly don't think they need anything else. What's Christmas about anymore, anyway? How many presents people get?
Well, of course not, but we've always tried to buy the things the kids put on their list. You know they expect it.
Well, that's exactly why we shouldn't do it this year. If they expect it, we've sent the wrong message. We've spent enough.
Why are you being such a tightwad? You know they'll fight if the presents aren't even. We work this out every year.
I'm just fed up with the whole glitter and garbage of buying everything everyone wants, half of which ends up in a yard sale by February anyway. Our credit card bills are sky high. The kids don't have a clue what it takes to give them everything on a frickin' silver platter.
Wow, crabby much? What's happened to you lately? You're acting moodier than my friend Julie before her lithium.
Nothing. Never mind. I'm just tired.
I know it's been a really long day, but can you please watch the kids tomorrow while I just run these last couple of errands? If you do, after I get back, I'll give you your present.
You'll come sit on my lap?
Yeah, sure thing. I've been a naughty girl or whatever. Gotta go get that popcorn.
2 weeks later now.
Here you go. There's a bunch today.
Ugh.
Well, it's not like we didn't know they were coming.
It doesn't make them any easier to open.
Well, we stayed way under budget this year. I got such great deals. Want a beer? You look like you've had a long day.
Yeah, I have. A beer would be great.
Valerie goes into the kitchen, and Frank opens the bills and looks at them.
Holy!
Everything...
Oh, my God!
Everything okay?
No! Did you see these?
No. You just opened them.
Did you know that two of the cards are maxed out? We got an overage charge on the MasterCard. What were you thinking?
Wait a minute. You told me I could get the last few things we needed for Christmas.
I said I'd watch the kids while you ran a couple of errands, not, Valerie, go put us in the hole.
Oh, so we'll pay it off this month and be done with it. Overcharge charges don't show up on your credit anyway.
You don't understand. We can't afford this on our cards. Not on something like Christmas. We need them for other stuff.
What other stuff?
Never mind what. We shouldn't even be maxed out in the first place. What happens if we have an emergency?
We have savings and other cards we can use. Why is this a big issue all of a sudden?
Now I know why suicide is highest right after the holidays.
What?
Nothing! I'll just take it out of our savings. We have got to pay this thing down.
Why our savings? Just spread it out over the next couple of paychecks like we did last year.
No, I don't want to do it that way. We need the breathing room now.
Why? Christmas is over. What else do we have to spend money on? We've always been able to pay off Christmas with a couple of payments.
Hey, Mom! Mom, Dad!
Hey, Bud. How was basketball?
Hey, awesome! Hey, I have something you need to sign. Permission slip for the class trip.
Oh, really? Where is it this year? D.C.?
Yep, here it is. I need to turn it in by Friday. Oh, and I have to take the deposit in by then, too.
What? What deposit? Did you know about this, Valerie?
You can't sign up for a trip without paying a deposit, Dad. I thought you said it was going to be fine, Mom.
Oh, you knew about this?
Yes, Frank. We've talked about it before. You know his class always takes a trip at the end of the year.
Well, how much is the deposit? How much does the whole thing cost?
Looks like the deposit is $100, and the full amount would be... $375, depending on how many kids sign up.
You mean it could be more?
I'm pretty sure $100 won't break us. Besides, we have all semester to come up with the rest.
All semester. Right.
What's that supposed to mean?
How are we supposed to plan if we don't even know how much it's going to cost? That's ridiculous.
What's ridiculous is you acting like we can't put a little money aside for a class trip.
The telephone rings.
I'll get it.
Ah, this is an epic fail.
Hey, Dad, where's Mom? I have to get to dance class in a half an hour. Does she have a check?
What check?
I have to pay for my recital costume. Does she have it?
How much do you need? Do you have to have it tonight?
Yeah. Mom knows about it.
Valerie, do we seriously have to pay for a costume tonight?
Oh, shoot. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. Go get your bag, sweetie. I'll leave in a minute. Okay, yeah, we have to pay for it. I can just use the Amex at the studio, and we can cover it with the end-of-the-month paycheck.
Ah! We're hemorrhaging money left and right! This has got to stop.
It's just a matter of cash flow, honey. We'll work it out.
Do not pay for that costume tonight, Val.
Isn't there a game on tonight? It'll be fine. Meg, time to leave. Oh, that was Julie on the phone? She said she saw you at the Daily Grind talking with a woman she didn't recognize. What were you doing there in the middle of the day? Didn't you have an all-day meeting yesterday?
Oh, this isn't about me. We need to talk before you spend any more money.
Oh, before I spend any more? You aren't seriously yelling at me about money, are you? All right. Who paid for the coffee yesterday? You or the mystery woman?
Just go.
A short time later.
So...
Did you end up paying for that costume?
Yeah, I already told you I had to. So... Who was the woman Julie saw you with yesterday?
That isn't what we were talking about before you left.
Oh, the heck it wasn't. Why were you having coffee in the middle of the day with that woman when you told me I couldn't call you because you had an all-day meeting?
It wasn't important.
Well, it was important enough to lie to me about. You grill me about every dime we spend, you yell at the kids, and now you won't tell me who you were with or why? Are you cheating on me?
No! It's nothing like that.
Well, what am I supposed to think?
I was laid off in December. We've been living off my severance, which is gone at the end of this month. The woman Julie saw me with yesterday was interviewing me for a job. I am not having an affair.
Oh, my gosh. Why didn't you say anything?
I couldn't. It was just before Christmas, and I didn't want to screw it up with you and the kids.
And you figured letting me spend money that we didn't have was a better idea?
My idea was to get a job before you realized we weren't getting paid anymore.
Well, your idea sucked. I never would have bought half the stuff I did if I'd known we were going to be this close to broke. What was the job interview for?
They made it sound like a marketing job. It turns out they wanted me to sell knives. The woman offered me the job, but I didn't take it. I think I'd end up slitting my wrist before I sold anything.
Sales isn't your strong suit anyway. It looks like we're going to have to tackle this as a team. I'm just going to throw this out there. What if I went back to work?
You? With a job? I was supposed to be earning enough for both of us. Plus, the kids need you here. Besides, I thought you were really into your bunco games and all that volunteer work you do.
No, don't be a goof. Do you really think that stuff is important to me? First of all, it's not the 1950s, so why should we wait around for you to find something when I've wanted to get out and work since the kids got into school anyway?
You're serious? You're telling me you really want a job? I just always thought you were better at spending money than making it. I mean, you're always telling me that it's just a cash flow problem and to relax. Even when we don't have...
Eggnog.
What?
It's like eggnog. Remember that drinking party when we met back in college?
Yeah?
Well, there was this huge punch bowl of eggnog that was almost empty, and I remember telling you I was one drink away from letting you have your way with me. You offered to get me another drink because there was a fly in the eggnog. Do you remember what I did?
You emptied out the rest of the punch bowl into your cup, fly and all, and then drank it. Yeah. I remember. What's that got to do with anything?
Well, think about it. If I can swallow a bug to impress you, why can't you swallow your pride and let me help? I mean, there's a ton of things we can do to get through this. I'll find some work. We can stick to a budget. I can be the crazy coupon-flipping mama. Can you believe that people still do that? It's all the rage this year, you know.
Okay, you win. I learn something new about you every day.
Good. I also hope you know that if I catch you lying again, we'll be having plum pudding, whether it's Christmas or not.
Before we get back to Columbus, do we have time for some more werewords?
For you, we'll make time. Here's one to start. Bayonet, the knife blade attached to a rifle. Was it so named because it was A, first used as a weapon to keep prisoners at bay? B, from Bayonne, the Spanish name for gun barrel. C, named for its place of origin, Bayonne, France.
The Louvre in Paris had an exhibit of these. As gunpowder replaced catapults and arrows, soldiers were extremely vulnerable when they were reloading. So soldiers around Bayonne started the practice of attaching a knife blade to the front of their rifles. How about the tasty little fruit, the tangerine? A, from the 1942 song by Johnny Mercer by the same name. B, so-called because of its tangy taste, or C, named for the Moroccan city of Tangiers.
I once had scurvy. It was awful. Sailors at sea used to get it, so ships would take on tangerines or mandarin oranges, which were loaded with vitamin C and prevented scurvy. The port they came from? Tangiers.
Bob, you never had scurvy.
Well, that's because I eat my tangerines.
And you never went to Morocco.
Didn't have to. They have a farmer's market. They also sell poinsettias at Christmas time. Did they get their name from A, Dr. J.R. Poinsett, 19th century Mexican ambassador who brought them to the U.S., or B, from their pointed leaves, or the Japanese word posuta, meaning poison, because eating the berries could be fatal?
This one is named for a person. The Mexicans associated it with Christmas because the flower looked like the Star of Bethlehem. They called it the Flower of the Blessed Night. When Dr. Poinsett brought one as a gift to the U.S., it was named after him. Okay, karaoke. A, from Japan's favorite folk song about hauling firewood. B, a contraction of two Japanese words meaning empty and orchestra. C, it's an Asian song style popularized on the island of Okinawa.
This word, like the practice, does not have a long history, so it hasn't had time to get to the Louvre yet. It was coined in 1981 from the Japanese words kara, meaning empty, and oki, short for orchestra. How about kaput. Did it come from A, Yiddish? It's what happens when you put the kibosh on something. B, Sanskrit, where Tupac means rich, and when reversed, it means poor. Or German, where kaput was a rendering of the French word capot, which meant to lose at cards.
Well, when you're in France, you have to visit Monte Carlo. I found out that if you have really bad luck playing cards, so bad that you don't take a single trick, you can tap out, or kaput. The Germans made it kaput.
Were you on the Riviera?
I didn't have time. I was busy at the farmer's market.
Buying tangerines.
No, they weren't in season. I was looking at gargoyles. I asked the guy where they came from, and he said, A, from the old French gargoyle, meaning throat. B, Irish architect Hedwig Argoyle, who used them in his designs. Or C, a Middle English contraction of garish and guile, which meant to both attract and fool evil spirits.
I'm surprised one of you guys didn't say it was what a pirate looks like when he gargles.
Oh. Now, you're going to be surprised at this, but they were early designs on French cathedrals used as drain spouts, and the weird-looking creatures would have water pouring out of their throats. The old French gargoyle, which would now be gargouille, which is the same base word for gargle, though it's not limited to pirates. All right, how about the old Scottish pastime of golf? Is it from A, the Scottish word golf, meaning to strike, B, Old English golf, a shepherd's crook, C, listen to this, Pam, an acronym for G-O-L-F, that is gentlemen only, ladies forbidden.
If it were that last one, someone would get golfed. Luckily, the Louvre does have an exhibit on this one. It comes from Scotland from about the 16th century and comes from a Scottish word meaning to strike.
Remember what Mark Twain said about golf? It was a good walk. Spoiled.
Okay, how about fork? A, from the Latin furca, a farmer's pitchfork. B, medieval slang for give, like fork over. Or C, the first French restaurant, Le Petit Fork, the little bite.
When in Rome, do as the Romans. It dates to the 4th millennium BCE, and it was modeled after the farmer's tool used to stack hay.
What do the Romans do in Rome?
Oh, that's easy. They speak Latin. Quid me anxious sum?
What? Me worry? Okay, let's get back to Columbus' second journey.
Now he comes to America.
Keep that thought. Columbus leaves Spain on September 24th, 1493. Only this time it is with 17 ships and 1,200 men to colonize the new area. The colonists include farmers, priests, and soldiers.
You see, the new idea is not colonies of exploitation, but colonies of settlement and conversion. They're going to make Christians out of the natives.
And they learned some sailing tricks, because this voyage, they make the Easter Islands in 3 weeks and land in the New World in another 3 weeks.
Now he's in America.
Keep hoping.
On November 3rd, 1493, he landed on an island he named Santa Maria la Galante. Over the next days, he sailed through the Lesser Antilles, sighting and naming Montserrat, Antigua, Redonda, Nevis, St. Kitts, St. Eustatius, Saba, St. Martin, and St. Croix. He also sighted an island chain which he named the islands of St. Ursula and the 1100 Virgins. That was a cumbersome name, so it was shortened to... Want to guess?
The Virgin Islands.
Yay!
Later, he journeyed through the Greater Antilles and landed on an island he named San Juan Bautista, later renamed Puerto Rico. And since Puerto Rico is now an American territory, did you know that's as close as Columbus got to setting foot on American soil?
Puerto Rico. Well, I'll be...
Most likely, Bob, but try to disguise it.
Well, I once bought a hat in Puerto Rico. Will that help?
On November 22nd, he returned to Hispaniola, only to find that the settlement had been destroyed. He found the bodies of 11 of his crewmen. Apparently, the Taino had revolted. He attempted another settlement in what is now the Dominican Republic, but that eventually failed.
He visited Cuba, naming it Juana, and then Jamaica, before finally returning to Spain on August 20th, 1494. It was almost 4 years later before he began his third voyage, leaving Spain on May 30th, 1498, with six ships.
On this voyage, he explored the coast of Venezuela and landed on the mainland of South America at the Orinoco River. He also named the islands of Tobago and Grenada.
What about the settlement back in Hispaniola?
He didn't forget about them, but when he returned on August 19th, he found that all was not happy in paradise. The Spanish settlers did not find life as easy as they had expected and no instant wealth. They blamed Columbus for all of their problems.
What did Columbus do?
In October 1499, he sent two ships back to Spain, asking for help governing. When the help arrived, it was not what Columbus expected. It was a new governor who listened to all the complaints and had Columbus and his brothers put in chains to be sent back to Spain for trial.
It was a year later that Columbus was finally sent to Spain. Once there, he spent another 6 weeks in jail before Ferdinand heard his case. At the trial, 23 witnesses testified that Columbus regularly used barbaric acts of torture. Even still, the king freed him and restored his wealth, but no more governorships. After much persuasion, they funded a fourth trip, and on May 12, 1502, he left Spain on his last journey.
Well, were they glad to see him when he returned?
Just the opposite. Nobody was glad to see him. When he arrived at Santo Domingo, he was refused permission to dock. He traveled to Honduras, Costa Rica, and Panama. While in Jamaica, he suffered ship damage and was stranded for over a year before he could get help repairing the ships. In order to get the natives to help, he correctly predicted a lunar eclipse by using an ephemeris that he carried. Finally, help arrived, and he set sail for home, arriving November 7th, 1504.
He later sued the Spanish crown for the 10% profits that he felt he was entitled to under his original contract. The crown said since he was to be removed as governor, there was no claim. After his death, the family continued to pursue legal action.
Columbus died on May 20th, 1506, and was buried in Seville. Subsequently, his remains were moved to Hispaniola, then to Cuba, and finally back to Seville. Although there is one tradition that says that they remain at Santo Domingo. Results from scientific testing are inconclusive, and authorities in Santo Domingo refuse to allow the body to be exhumed.
So, he never reached the shores of America?
Nope.
And he committed all kinds of atrocities against the natives?
Yep.
And we still have a holiday in his honor.
We have yet to look at his legacy.
Well, let me think about this for a bit.
While you're thinking, let's have a look at some more word origins.
More where words?
Sure. Here's a few on how some countries got their names. The first, the Philippines. A tag-along word, Philippi, for erupting volcanoes. B, name given by a Spanish explorer in 1542 for King Philip of Spain. C, from the book of the Bible, Philippians.
There's an exhibit at the Louvre about this. The 1,700-plus islands in the May Peninsula were named after King Philip. By the way, did you know they were Spanish colonies from 1521 to 1849?
If they were colonies since 1521, why were they not named until 1542?
That was also in the exhibit. Magellan was there in 1521 and named it San Lazaro. Later it was renamed Filipas by Ruy López de Villalobos. How about Bolivia? A, it was named after South American revolutionary leader Simón Bolívar. B, it was named for Bolvana, a mythical Incan paradise. Or C, from the Spanish, Bolina and Via, for the shining way.
I studied history in school. It wasn't named after the country. The country was named after him. He was called the Liberator. Simón Bolívar.
It's Simón Bolívar.
Oh.
I thought you studied this in school.
I guess they didn't cover it in Latin. How about India? From the word Indian, from the country's highest caste or class. It's the feminine form of Indio, one of the twin gods of fertility. It's from the Indus River, Sindhu, which is the Sanskrit word for river.
Maybe your Latin class wasn't taught in Latin that day.
That must have been it.
Anyway, some of the earliest people in the history of the world lived along the banks of the Indus. They were named after the river. Now, Argentina, from the Argenis, a poem written by poet Gabriel Marquez. B, from the Latin word for silver, argentum. C, it's named after Spanish explorer Juan Argento, who died there.
Can I answer? I know Latin.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, it is Latin, but it means Evo weeps.
What?
Andrew Lloyd Webber translated it.
It must have been a later translation. It is Latin, but it means silver. That's because early Spanish explorers found great amounts of silver washed from underground deposits by the river they called Rio Plata, i.e. Silver River. Next, Portugal. A, from the Latin portus, Calais, it was Roman port. B, it was considered the front porch to Spain. Or C, named after legendary hero Portuga, whose troops rid Lisbon of the Huns.
Since I know Latin, the Romans defeated the Celts here around 200 BCE. The name stuck. Next, China. A, from Genghis Khan, who named it after his wife, Kachina, was named for the Qin dynasty that unified China, or from the Persian word chini, for the porcelain made there. I'll give you a hint. The Latins taught the Persians everything they know, even their language.
Bob, there were no Latins. They were Romans. They spoke Latin.
No Latins? Well, then who taught them Latin?
My, my. All right, the answer is the Qin dynasty that ruled from 221 to 205 BCE. The country took their name. This one should be easy. France. A, it comes from the early German invaders, the Franks. B, it is named after their earliest ruler, Francis I. C, being Roman Catholic, it is named for Pope Franciscus.
Kurt, what did you say earlier? Omnia Gallia est divisa in tres partes? Well, here's the proof. Early France was a part of Gaul and was run by the Roman Empire until the Franks conquered it in 486. Finally, America. A, from Latin, Americ, for abundant. B, Marica, the Algonquin name for tall boat. Or C, named for early Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci.
Well, I know it's Vespucci, but why isn't it Columbia? Columbus discovered it. Well, maybe he didn't discover it. It was there all the time. But at least he was there before Vespucci.
Blame it on a German cartographer, Martin Waldseemüller. He literally put America on the map.
Right. You see, despite what Columbus and others thought, Vespucci argued that this was truly a new world and not part of the Indies.
So Waldseemüller gave the credit to Vespucci and named it after Amerigo. America.
Way to go, Amerigo.
Pam, were you really in Paris all those times?
I've never been to Paris.
But you said all those things were on exhibit in Paris.
They brought the exhibit to me.
Our final thoughts about Christopher Columbus. What was it that made him worthy of the honors that have been bestowed upon him? He set out to accumulate a fortune for himself. The contract he negotiated with the Spanish crown before his first voyage would have made him extremely wealthy.
He seems also interested in obtaining as much gold for himself as possible. On his first voyage, he noticed the natives wearing gold bracelets. He forced them to tell where they got it. They led him to Hispaniola.
It was there that he left the first settlement of 39 men. Maybe one ship had sunk, but there was gold. When he returned, the settlement was destroyed by the revolt by the people that had been enslaved. But seemingly, what irritated Columbus most was that there was no gold.
Well, really, that there was so little gold. But meantime, he had investors to pay. So on the next trip, he returned to South America on the island of Haiti. He ordered all the people 14 years of age and older to collect a minimum amount of gold each month. If they didn't, he cut off their hands.
Natives that tried to escape were hunted down with dogs and killed. The Arawak that he first encountered killed their own children instead of letting them fall into the hands of those who were supposedly there to teach them about Christ.
He saw slavery as a right and proper way of dealing with the natives. After his second voyage, he took 500 prisoners back to sell. 200 of them died on the way back, but the rest brought a profit.
He also had a curious way of going about his slave dealing. Since Roman Catholic law at that time forbade using other Christians as slaves, he refused to allow the natives to be baptized. Some of his crewmen disobeyed his orders, and he had them hung.
Since he first wrote about how easy it would be to make them Christians, I guess he changed his mind after he started selling them.
Maybe. And he had a great sense of justice for himself. Here follows a portion of a letter he wrote while in prison awaiting his trial. Over there I have placed in their sovereignty more land than there is in Africa and Europe, and more than 1,700 islands. In 7 years I, by the divine will, made that conquest. At a time when I was entitled to expect rewards in retirement, I was incontinently arrested and sent home with chains. The accusation was brought out of malice on the basis of charges made by civilians who had revolted and wished to take possession of the land. I, now at the end of my days, have been despoiled of my honor and my property without cause, wherein is neither justice nor mercy.
And if that same letter had been written by a native? So, why a holiday?
Well, we can't answer that, except to say that regardless of what you thought about him, he did change history.
Remember the furor when Time magazine named Hitler as the man of the year for 1938? They tried to explain that they didn't do it because he was so good or so great, but because by far he had the greatest impact on the world, good or bad.
Well, the same can be said about Columbus. Again, good or bad, he changed the world. His voyages opened a new page in human history that changed civilizations.
Yeah, I guess so. But he couldn't have done it without a Norwegian map.
Now that I cannot argue with.
No, but I can argue with a Norwegian.
Ooh, can I watch?
Did You Know airs 3 times weekly, Thursday at 9 p.m., Saturday at noon, and Sunday evening at 8. And podcasts are available on our website.
You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Kurt Benrood, thanking you for listening.
And Pam Vesper. Consideration for this program was provided by Drs. Michael and Leslie Martin in support of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
And this is Bob Martin, asking you again to call in to TRRS and tell us what other things you might like to hear on Did You Know? Or if you would also like to provide consideration for our special programming, the number is 919-832-5138.
Goodbye.